You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is the president of Belmont Abbey College in Charlotte, North Carolina, a very fine Catholic college, and has become finer and even more Catholic since Dr. Bill Thurfelder, who is our guest, has been president. He went there in 2004, since then has built the college to national prominence. He has also strengthened its core Catholic identity, and he also became visible in the fight against the Health and Human Services mandate requiring Catholic colleges to provide contraception and abortifacient contraception to faculty and staff. He actually testified before the U.S. Congress on this issue. But the reason we're having him here is because in his first life, before he became a Catholic college president, Bill Thurfelder was in the world of sports in many different ways. He was part of a company called the Joyner Sports Medicine Institute. He was also executive director of the Player Management Group. And he was also what we know as a sports psychologist. So he handled players from a financial, contractual point of view. He handled players from a physical point of view, that is, their physical well-being. But he also handled them from a mental, spiritual point of view, which I know because I've benefited. I'll talk with Bill and our listeners a little bit later about how I myself benefited from it. But, Bill, when you participated in the 1980 Olympic trials in Eugene, Oregon, and medaled, just what race were you running?
Well, actually, I was a high jumper in 1980, and I qualified for the U.S. Olympic trials out in Eugene, Oregon. I medaled at the 1981 U.S. Olympic National Championships, and that's a long, long story how I ended up associated with the Irish national team, and I won't go into that right now, but it's been an interesting life and wonderful experiences.
I didn't realize you were born and raised in New York City, because you don't act like it, and but I have known you now for over 10 years and have watched, as many have, the great job you've done at Belmont Abbey in Charlotte, North Carolina. But you've published a new book, which I've read. It's entitled Less Than a Minute or Two Ago. It has you holding a stopwatch, a very handsome picture of you.
Yeah.
The subtitle is The Secret to World-Class Performance in Sport, Business, and Everyday Life. And, again, this is one of these books that when you read it, you think it was written just for you, because I started marking multiple things on every page as I went through. And it's interesting to me, Bill Thurfelder, Dr. Bill Thurfelder, how good a case you make for extending the kinds of things that sports psychologists do to life in general. I mean, that I think is one of the great strengths of your book. Is that what you're trying to do?
Well, I guess I have to start first by telling you, Deal, I never wanted to write the book. I just didn't have time to do it. And people for many years have been asking, and I know you've done many books, and I'm sure maybe you started up the same way, but many people ask you to do this, and usually you don't have the time to do it. And divine providence has always guided me all my life and has brought me places that I think just proves God's existence, because I shouldn't be in all the places that I've been in, and writing a book is probably one of them. But I was asked to write this book, and I just said, I really can't do it. And in a way, I was a little bit drawn into it, because they said, well, you do this podcast. We'll just take your podcast. We'll have to put that together, and then, you can edit it later. And I thought, well, yeah. And then they said, it'll benefit Belmont Abbey College. I mean, you can just do this for Belmont Abbey College. And that was enough for me. I said, okay, I'll do it for the college. So I think I'm going down this path where I'm not really writing this book. But after the first chapter came back, I said, oh, my gosh. It just was so far off from where I just said, I can't have this. This isn't me, you know. So I suddenly came to the recognition and realization, I'm going to have to write this book. And so it was a family effort, because God bless my family. They allowed me to do this, and they helped me and kibitzed on, stories that I was going to include. I said, what about this one? Oh, yeah, it's a good one. Add that one in. And so it really came about. But as I said, anything good in it, I attribute to the Holy Spirit. I mean, he's been speaking the truth for all of ages, for all people, little different ways, but same message of truth. And anything else I'll take credit for. So it's an unusual book, as you've probably experienced, because when you start out in that book, you don't know where that book's going to finish. I mean, it really takes you, in a lot of different directions over the course of it.
Well, let's just start with one story you tell. I mean, one thing you do in the first chapter, and I think very prudently done. I mean, we hear so much lately about all the bad things that are happening in sport, all the drugs and racism and whatever. I mean, the headlines now are filled with negative stories about sport. You got to tell our listeners about the Australian runner John Landry. I had never heard that story, and it gave me chill bumps to hear it. And I immediately went to YouTube and watched a 2-minute Pathé News video report about it. And I'm just amazed that I had never heard that story, because, as a golfer, as I am, it not just good manners, but sportsmanship is very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, you're a witness in virtue is what you really witnessed there.
Yeah.
And that's what stood out. And what's amazing about that story, for the people that don't know John Landy, he was one of the three guys that was vying to break the 4-minute mile. It was Roger Bannister and John Landy and one other individual, Wes Emery from the United States. And they were trying to break the 4-minute mile. And in the 1956 Australian National Championships, everybody had come to see John Landy break his world record at the time. And the place was packed, 20,000 people. They were up on the hillsides outside the stadium. And the race starts off, and it's the old cinder track, If people don't know that. It's not the rubberized track. It's the old cinder tracks where you have the big spikes, and it's like running more like on a dirt kind of surface. And after the first lap, they're right on pace for breaking the 4-minute mile. After the second lap, again, they're right on pace for breaking this world record time. And as they are in the midst of going into the third lap, all the runners are kind of juggling for space. And one of the runners' name was Ron Clark, and a guy cut in front of him. And when the guy in front, his foot came up, Ron Clark's foot caught the back of his heel, and he goes sprawling out onto the cinders, just face down. And people are jumping and moving all around them. And John Landy, who was behind, didn't see this happen. But as he, you're running along at a fast pace, and suddenly he sees Ron Clark there, and he attempts to jump over him. And when he does, he almost clears him, but not quite. His 1-inch spikes caught the shoulder of Ron Clark and actually tore into his shoulder. And then the most amazing thing happened. Everybody else continues to run, but John Landy immediately stops his momentum about 10 yards after he made contact with Ron Clark, stops, turns around, goes back, grabs a hold of him, picks him up, runs the cinders off his knee and says, are you okay? Ron Clark is in shock, I think, that John Landy has stopped and come back, and he screams and he says, I'm fine, run, run. And so John Landy, turns around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm watching this on tape, and I can't believe it. He started out, 40 yards behind?
Or more. I think it was estimated 150 yards behind.
Right. Behind the group that he allowed to pass him because he stopped to help the man who fell down and whom he accidentally spiked in the shoulder.
Yes. And what's amazing is he's a man possessed by grace, because as he runs up that straightaway, being now 150 yards behind, you would think this guy is a world-class 100-meter runner. I mean, he is sprinting up that straightaway something you've never seen.
He's flying.
And as he catches up by the by the end of the third lap, going into the fourth lap, he's now towards the back of the pack. As they come off the final turn, he actually takes the lead, passes the leader, takes it down the straightaway, wins the race.
Well, frankly, they look like they're standing still as he goes by them.
Yes, yeah, it's just amazing. And so the first thing he does, though, and you know, instead of everybody now pumping their chest and running around, the very first thing he does is he goes back to the finish line and he looks for Ron Clark because he wants to make sure he's really okay. And once he finds out he's okay, he's just ready to leave the track. But the entire stadium, all the people on the hills, they're chanting, Landy, Landy, Landy. And he, you know, they wanted to take a victory lap, and he does not want to do this. And by the way, he ended up running 4 minutes and 4 seconds, but they estimated that at least, at the minimal, it took him 7 seconds with the time that he stopped and the time that he started back up again. Some people said it could have been as long as 15 seconds. But there is no doubt that he would have broken the world record easily if he had kept running. And yet he stopped and went back and found Ron Landy. Well, the crowd just would not stop. And so he finally, reluctantly, kind of almost head down, you know, took a victory lap, and the entire place is just chanting Landy and will not stop. And I said, you know, it's interesting. John Landy, as great a guy as he was, and he really was a good person, a very virtuous man in all aspects of his life, And he broke the world record after that, and he had many great successes, but the thing he's most remembered for is that moment of virtue and sportsmanship when he went back to a fallen comrade to make sure he was okay before taking care of himself.
Yes, and, you know, in this whole first chapter, you tell the story, and these remarkable stories, not just John Landy but a few others, about cases of what I would call extreme sportsmanship, and you make the distinction between those who play for love of the game, and those who play to get a pat on the back.
Right.
And you come back to that image of getting, you know, patted on the back. I think you call it chapped on the – what do you call it?
A clap on the back. We all love the clap on the back because it feels – we don't say this, but it feels like that love thing. I mean, it feels good to us. And athletes are notorious. I mean, you play golf, you know, you're a very, very good competitor. And you know that that can kind of take you over if you're not aware of it, because there's a sense of, if I play well, I feel good. If I play bad, I feel bad.
Well, you know, by the way, it's beautifully written, and it reads very fluidly, and it's enjoyable. It's a book I highly recommend. Let me name it again. It's called Less Than a Minute to Go, The Secret to World-Class Performance in Sport, Business, and Everyday Life, published by our good friends at St. Benedict Press. Beautifully printed, great cover, a well-made book, by the way. And as I read it, I thought, you know, this applies to all of our endeavors. I mean, and you make the case that if you are playing a sport or doing anything in order to get a clap on the back, it will very soon create a deep lack of satisfaction inside of you. Now, why does that happen?
Because what unfortunately happens, and again, every athlete I've ever worked with in my whole life, I mean, at the very highest professional level down to, you know, youth, what starts to happen is that being good enough gets tied with being loved. And they have nothing to do with each other, but as athletes, we tend to tie them together over time. And so what happens is that you only have 100% to give at any given moment, and eventually you're giving all that you have to whatever, you know, things you've taken on, and you don't have 1% left to put into anything new to get a new clap on the back. And everything else has become expected and accepted. So, for example, when you start playing golf, if nobody knows that you can play golf, the first time you go out, if you play what the world says, hey, that was really great, baby. Wow, you are really, really good. That's a big clap on the back. It feels great. But after a while, if you go out and you win a lot or you perform very well, then the one time you come in, maybe, like, let's say you got fifth place instead of winning, but people have been used to seeing you win, most people say to you, well, what happened?
Oh, boy. I've been there, so if you do.
And it kills you. And so what ends up happening is once you don't have that 1% left to get a new clap on the back and to get that love feeling thing, you usually get a strong feeling. And it's either anger, depression, sadness, frustration. It's something. It's usually a bad feeling. You don't like it. But and you might not realize where it comes from, but it's tying together how I perform with really, am I lovable? Am I a good enough person? And the two have nothing to do with each other.
And by the way, you draw this comparison. It's what parents sort of do to their kids unawares. I mean, they ask their kids to become A students, And then once they start making A's, the parents go, attaboy, attaboy. But then as the A's start rolling in quarter after quarter, the parents don't say attaboy anymore. It's expected. The only time the kids get feedback is when a B or a C shows up, right?
Right. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So this creates...
You have to give an accounting for your C. Like, why? What happened? So now not only are you not getting a clap on the back, it's actually kind of a demotion, you know, in some way. It's like a, you know, further loss. But the reason parents, I often say, can't win is think about this. You know, with your son, for example, I could give some advice. I could say something to him, right? And he can take it or leave it because, you know, who am I? You know, you need to say, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, walk away. But if dad says something... We are just made that we want our mother and father to love us and be proud of us and to think well of us. And so it's inherent. I mean, it could be tiddlywinks. He could be playing tiddlywinks. And if you say, hey, how'd the tiddlywinks go today? It starts to mean, well, it must be important to you because you're talking about it. And I want
right.
that to love me and be proud of me. So I guess I have to now do this well, even though he's the one that said I wanted to play tiddlywinks. I mean, you didn't say, hey, you got to go play tiddlywinks. And this could be whether it's golf or basketball or playing the violin or, you know, whatever it would be. Once dad or mom starts talking about it, there's something else attached to it, and it's this love thing. It's the most motivating thing to any human being, and our parents are the ones that are most powerful in that. And so when they start talking about it, love is attached to it, and now instead of this thing I enjoy doing that I want to do, it gets turned around into like kind of a have to. I sort of have to do this now to please you. Now think of the other extreme. You say, okay, I don't want that to happen, so now I'm going to take a new strategy. I'm just not going to say anything to you about it. Well, what kind of father would you be if your son came home and he said, hey, you know, I'm playing basketball and everything? He said, well, that's going to be fine. And you walk away from him. He's going to say, what's wrong with dad? You know, he doesn't love me. He doesn't care about me. Doesn't care. I mean, so you really almost can't win it. But the way that you can overcome it is by having this actual discussion with your children so they recognize this is the kind of thing that can affect them if they're not aware of it. And once you're aware of it, it has less of that ability to be used, I guess, against you.
So how do you make this transition from whether it's sports or acting or making good grades or whatever it is you do, how do you make this transition from doing things for the clap or pat on the back to doing things for their intrinsic value?
Well, you get to the deepest questions about life, which doesn't surprise me, given all that you've done with philosophy and biology and so forth.
I'm just one of those guys.
Really, it gets to the root of why do we do anything? I mean, in other words, why are we here? You know, what is our ultimate purpose? And if that's not clear to us, we're going to make the mistake of getting caught up in the world of money, power, fame, and pleasure. And as you know well as anybody, St. Thomas Aquinas talked about those things, and he said, if you don't have your first, and he's pointing up, you know, he's pointing to God, love, you know, if you don't have God first, those four things have the potential to become addiction because they will never fill you up sufficiently. And unfortunately for many people, they're pursuing the love thing thinking, if I just have enough money, if I have enough power or enough fame or whatever it might be, I'm going to ultimately be happy and always feeling like I'm just a fraction away from it. But my experience in life has shown me none of those things ultimately make you happy. And I give the analogy. I said, you know, I can prove it to you. I said, you know, love is most motivating, and it's not the money, power, fame. And I said, I'll prove it to you. I'll give you $1 billion, and I'll make you president. I don't know if you want to be or not. But the only stipulation to this is you got to go live on a deserted island for the rest of your life. I've never had anybody tell me they would take that deal.
Now,
right. A few tired parents sometimes in the audience who would take a couple weeks on the island, but. You know, nobody's going to take that deal because obviously there's something significantly missing there. If money, power, fame were truly most motivating, you'd take the deal. But what's not there are people. And with people, there's a potential for love and relationships, which is really what we want most. And so by recognizing that, it frees us up to start to focus on, well, then what is my purpose? And ultimately it has nothing to do with God and my relationship with God and the fact that I am a steward of what he's given me. So Matthew 25:14-30, the parable of the talents. He's asking me to do the most with what he's giving me. He's asking me to double what he's given me. And in statistics, double means 100%. I mean, give back all. And so if that becomes our focus, first of all, I think you'll be brought to a greater height than to do it for some of the other self-serving reasons that ultimately do not fill you up. They can work for a little bit. They can kind of be a sort of a motivation to some people, but in the end, you will not be happy.
Well, I'm talking with Dr. Bill Thurfelder, president of Belmont Abbey College, Catholic College in Charlotte, North Carolina, and author of a wonderful new book called Less Than a Minute to Go. It's about achieving, I should say, optimum performance, as it is called, in whatever you're doing, whether it's sports, business, or just living your life. Now I'm going to tell my story about you. And you'll recall that some years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, I came to you at an airport, I think we ran into each other, or it was a conference. And I said, Bill, I'm having some trouble with my golf. I play very well, but then when I get in a competitive situation under pressure, I find myself, my swing breaking down. I find that I'm just not, I get a little bit nervous and things go awry. And you took me aside and you said, just look at the ball and look, in fact, look at a dimple on the ball, let your mind clear and hit it. In other words, I think you said to me originally, Deal, you're not looking at the ball. Which, of course, I went, what? What do you mean I'm not looking at the ball? And then
you're saying that white fuzzy thing, and you know, it's even looking inside the dimple. You know, can you see a detail within the dimple? Because that is the secret to, in a sense, peak performance. It's attention to detail. The more attention that you place yourself, the more detail you try to look at, even if you can't see it. It's what brings you to that level of, quote, being in the zone or playing at a very high level. It's when you lose attention to detail that your mind is freed up now to think of all kinds of things that have nothing to do with actually striking the ball.
Well, I want you to know that you set me on a road that, and basically the road was this. Okay, I've spent all my life learning how to swing, how to hit the ball, how to putt, et cetera, et cetera. But I haven't spent all my life getting my mind ready to compete under pressure. And as Bobby Jones famously said, there's golf, there's tournament golf, and there's, you know, casual golf, and they're two completely different animals. And so I started committing myself to this. It took a few years, and it took me competing a lot and losing. It took me competing a lot and screwing up. But I finally got to the point where just this last year, at the age of 64, I went to Scotland and won a major tournament. And I beat the whole field, including the 20-year-old, the 30-year-old, and the 40-year-old. And it's funny because after I was told I won the tournament, I had to say, what? You're kidding. I mean, I hadn't even been thinking about winning the tournament. I had only been thinking about hitting shots.
Right.
And then it sunk in. I felt so deeply humbled. I did not feel excited, really. I didn't feel proud. I just felt like I had been given the greatest gift. It was this amazing reaction I had. And then when they handed me the trophy, they asked me to make a simple speech, and I just said, I've been playing golf since I was 11, and nothing I've ever done in golf or ever will do in golf will mean as much to me as this. And, of course, the Scots who, you know, love golf and they see golf as part of life, they loved it because they knew it was sincere. But what they didn't know is I had spent all those years trying to get my mind and my attitude into a place where I could, as you say, put myself in the zone.
And a lot of that, you know, which again applies to every aspect of life, is really, in a sense, getting rid of the kind of false beliefs, the expectations, all the other stuff that just has nothing to actually do with what you're doing at the moment. So really what it's about is that you have 100% to give at any given moment. If you put the whole 100% into what it actually takes. So as you described, I mean, I call it playing ball to ball. You're not playing golf because golfers score and you look at scores all the time. It's playing ball to ball. And what you're basically doing is you're looking at this one ball. You immediately look down and your eyes go immediately to a spot. That's your target. Now you know your spot. You're not saying, hey, somebody told me about the wind, as if your body and mind couldn't, you know, take that in. You know, you look down, you get your spot. You look back, you take a practice swing that you believe would put it on that spot. You then step up to your ball. You look in complete detail. As detailed, I mean, you know, I could have anybody listening to you right now. If you picked out an object in the room, you know, something small, maybe looking like it's partially connected to something, but maybe you can't quite make it out, really look at it closely and see, is it touching? And when you're doing that, for that fraction of a second, your body, mind, and soul, all of you is completely absorbed in that. That's when people say focus, that's what they're talking about.
That's what happened to me, Bill. And I went on to, by the way, I went on to win the World Amateur Hickory Golf Championship in Scotland a few months later. And a couple of other championships here.
Work. Now, I will tell you this. I don't know if you experienced this. Tell me if you did. When I worked with a lot of pro golfers, in the beginning, you know, and I'm not saying this was you, but they were so desperate, usually the situation that we're in, they're willing to try anything. So I'm suggesting to them to play this ball-to-ball way where they're just completely absorbed, play ball-to-ball, you keep going until they tell you to stop, and at the end they'll say, hey, here's your score. At first they're willing to do that because they're desperate. They're about to go off the tour anyway, so they figure, I might as well try this. And suddenly they start playing extraordinarily well. Now, they're just playing up to their ability finally, and I've had some that went into the top 10 on the tour. And then what happens very shortly after that is they start to fall apart a little bit. And it sounds strange, but actually the winning can be as distracting as the losing, if you allow it to be. Because, again, winning has nothing to do with what you're actually doing. And sometimes all of the good stuff that comes with, again, the claps on the back and people saying, hey, you really played well, and that's great. These all seem very positive things. There's nothing negative about them, but they have nothing to do with what you're actually doing. So there's a great discipline, if you will, to keep your mind playing ball to ball regardless of what's happening. And after you've taken that swing, that practice swing, and hit that spot on the ball that you've been really focused on, the first thing that should come to you, and you don't even say these words, I have to say, people will know what I'm talking about, but the first thing is, was that my swing? If it wasn't, you can feel the difference between what you wanted versus what you did, move on to your next ball. If it was exactly what you wanted, move on to your next ball. And you just repeat this over and over and over again. And that discipline of doing that, regardless of whether you're, quote, winning or losing, which have nothing to do with the outcome, by the way, how you do this ball to ball is going to determine in the end where you fall as far as a winning or losing goes.
I'm talking with Dr. Bill Thurfelder about his help in getting me started to becoming not just a good golfer, but a golfer who wins an occasional tournament and enjoys golf more. But he's got a whole book about how you can enjoy your life more and your job more and your relationships more and your marriage more. It's called Less Than a Minute to Go, and we will be back talking more with him just after this message.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a contribution made from our day sponsor, to honor St. Thomas More on the eve of his feast day. More is the patron saint of lawyers and adopted children. A true voice for justice, More was martyred because of his opposition to the redefinition of marriage. St. Thomas More, pray for us. If you have a message you want to share, be a day sponsor at 877-288-1077.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. C.S. Lewis famously wrote that we are secret agents behind enemy lines. It's true. This world is under hostile rule, and its prince is in full-scale rebellion against our Father in heaven, with a mission to take as many souls with him as possible. Our mission, should we choose to accept it, is to raid and poach in Satan's territory and rescue souls out from under him. We should not be surprised or dismayed at opposition. Of course Satan will work to stop us, but we have a clear promise that we are equipped and commissioned to do the job. We are called to attack the kingdom of the world and rescue souls in bondage to the world, the flesh, and the devil, and bring them to our Father's heavenly kingdom. Are you ready?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews when I interview an extraordinary author of 50 books, National Book Award winner Gloria Whalen. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. or Sunday at 9:30 a.m.
I'm back talking with Dr. Bill Thurfelder, who is president of Belmont Abbey College in Charlotte, North Carolina, a great Catholic college, also former sports manager, sports physiologist, sports psychologist, you name it. And we've been talking about his book and also about how he helped me personally. And he raised the question before we went to break about what happens to people who break through, you know, whether or not they start making A's or they break through and get their PhD after, you know, putting it off for years, or they break through in their job, or they break through in relationship, or in my case, break through to win golf tournaments, how there's a temptation then to begin to fall into the same kind of dynamic of being concerned about what others think, about whether others clap you on the back all over again. It's like the temptation is right there, and it's even perhaps even stronger now, right?
Well, again, it goes back to, let's say, okay, you just won a tournament. Everybody's saying, Dio, you are just awesome. You know, this is great. And so now you go to the next tournament, and when you get there, people are saying to you, hey, you're the best. Gosh, you're going to take this thing easy today and so forth. Now, those are all very nice things, and you're smiling and thinking, isn't that nice of them to say, right?
Right.
But what does that have to do with seeing your target, feeling your body, seeing the ball? Nothing. So if that at all occupies the 100% that you have to give, and you only have 100, there is no, as I say, secret slice under the pie. There's only 100%. There is no 110. If you don't put the 100% into seeing your target, feeling your body, seeing the ball, if you don't do that, you are not going to perform as well, which means you're going to go back to kind of the way you were playing before. Now, before you blamed it on the fact that you had negative thoughts. These are positive thoughts. But in either case, the negative or the positive thoughts have nothing to do with actually what you're doing, which is seeing a target, feeling your body, seeing the ball, reproduce the swing, move on.
And so this sort of conversion experience, if you want to call it that, of doing things, whether it's sports or anything, not for the recognition, not for the pat on the back, not for the applause, not for the media attention or whatever, you never really establish complete freedom from that temptation. In fact, the more success you have, the more temptation you're going to have, right?
Well, you can, but then isn't that like life? You know, there's lots of temptations in life, and that's why God gave us free will. You know, we can decide what we're going to do with those temptations when they come. Now, obviously, we ask for God's grace to overcome them, but we also have to cooperate with it as well. So, you know, it brings up the whole point of play. You know, it's interesting to me when in the book I talk a little bit about it. Before I get to sport, you know, there's this thing called play.
And I'm so glad you kind of got philosophical on the concept of play. And you actually went back to some of the great classic texts on that.
If anybody would appreciate it, Dio, you would.
I did. I loved it. How does play distinguish itself from non-play?
Well, play, first of all, what's interesting about it to me is that every human being that's ever existed from the beginning of time has played. And that's a wild thought. You know, you can't say that about a lot of things. And you got to say then, well, is there something important about play? In other words, what is that about human beings and play? And a lot of times we think of play as just being like little kid stuff that they do and really has nothing to do with us, but sport actually is one, just basically four forms of play. Sport or competitive activity is one of them. And what's interesting about play to me is that everybody has talked about play. I mean, people that you'd be least likely to think about, St. Augustine, St. Francis of Sales, you know, obviously St. Paul talked about it.
Obviously St. Francis himself.
St. Francis, St. Augustine said, you know, he played ball games. Can you picture St. Augustine playing ball games? I mean, I just don't think of him that way, typically. And then if you go back far enough, I mean, you got Plato and Socrates and Aristotle all talking about play. And even Scripture, if you go back to the Old Testament, it's Proverbs 8, and it says, I was God's delight day after day, playing before God all the time, playing in the world, in God's earth, my delight was with humankind. And so play is a lot like wisdom. It's done for its own sake. It's not done for some kind
of... That's a very good point. I mean, Aristotle said that the peak of happiness is contemplation, an act that is done entirely for its own sake, not for the sake of pleasure, for the sake of recognition or power or anything else. And if you take your play, which is supposed to be done for itself, and make it into something you do for some other sake, then you've ruined the essence of play, right?
Yeah, and in a way we've kind of tricked ourselves because we still call things play that really in some ways have become selfish works, and we're still calling them play.
I played with a few golfers who were definitely at work when they were on the golf course. They weren't playing. I hate those guys. I hate those guys.
Well, and the whole point to this play thing is that I would say sport is very much like a beautiful cathedral or a great work of art. And we know that those kinds of things were made to try to lift our eyes up, to make us think about God, to help us contemplate God. And I would say sport done, even by, it doesn't have to be the best person in the whole world, but sport done extraordinarily well, to me, makes me think of God. Because I don't know about you, but even probably for yourself, if you've ever hit a perfect drive just down the middle of the, you know, the fairway, just a beautiful shot that you just rise up and beautiful arc, and it lands on the beautiful grass and just rolls for yards, it lifts you up. I mean, it's something to...
Well, I mean, you know that's how I feel, but I don't think non-golfers would understand that.
I'll take David Rhodesia, who won the half mile in the London Olympics.
Right.
He led from the beginning of the race. He broke the world record by himself. And I am telling you, when I watched David Rhodesia run that half mile, I really did think of God, because I thought it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. His form, his commitment, his perseverance, his strength, his courage. I mean, it was all there on display. I mean, it was like virtue in motion, which is...
And by the way, we need to get that name, that word virtue, into our discussion, because, for example, you say here in the middle of the book, the part of the problem in sport today is that it is no longer viewed as an opportunity for developing virtue. When I was a kid and learning to play baseball, we always talked about character. We always talked about how this was going to help us build character, and that meant sportsmanship, and that meant learning how to win gracefully and lose gracefully and so forth.
Right.
And is it the case that in things like Little League and soccer and junior golf and all these things, that this is not something that is discussed very much?
Well, I think now it's just done randomly. Sometimes you'll have somebody who's aware of it and tries to incorporate it, but many times, I think more often than not nowadays, it's not the case. It's really come down to the end game, which is it's all about winning.
I mean, is that why the dads and moms get on the sideline of Little League games and act like total jerks?
But nobody, that's the problem. In world-class performance or regular performance, if you're not aware of what you're doing, you have no chance of changing. And that is also true of the way you approach sport. If you're not aware that you're approaching this way, it's going to happen, and you're not even going to recognize it. You're going to think this is all normal, and it's not. It's really abnormal. You know, play is interesting to me. We're so wired for it that we're even willing to watch, to pay other people so that we can watch it. I mean, think about that idea. We go to places, pay a lot of money so we can sit there and watch somebody else play. So if it's truly play, it's something that's good for us. When it becomes, again, more of a selfish work, there's something wrong with it. And that's where we get into all the problems that we see. And we can then, to be honest, make a mistake of thinking, well, sport's terrible. I don't want anything to do with it because it's a terrible thing. That's not where we're called to be. We're called to take back the game and make it what it was supposed to be and make it about character and make it about the development of virtue.
You know, I love your book, but a lot of people, you know, when they see the word virtue, they roll their eyes. All you mean by that is the classic meaning of moral habits that make up our character. You remember William James' famous quote where he says, you know, sow a seed, you grow an action, turns into habits, turns into character, turns into happiness or unhappiness.
Right.
And so the, you know, separate actions, if they're done over time and repeated, will become a habit. For example, compassion. If you act compassionately, consistently over a certain period of time, that will become a permanent disposition in your character. It's something that you're disposed to do when the opportunity presents itself. That's what we mean by virtue. But there are also vices, things that we are disposed to do that aren't so good. And sport, why is it that sport is particularly suited to the not to the teaching of virtue, because you can't really teach virtue, I don't think, but to the making of virtue in people.
Yeah, I think of it as good formation. So let's just give an example. Why sport's so good at to start with is that it's this artificial environment. We've created this artificial setting, this artificial thing, you know, whether it's golf or whatever it is. There's sort of rules that go with it. There's a defined space and time and place of all these things. And so we've created this little world for a moment to say, okay, we have an opportunity now within that little artificial world. As you just pointed out, you can develop vice or you can develop virtue. So how is that going to be formed? And it really means, and this is what's very important, is that coaches be teachers and mentors first. Because as an example, let's say I come in as a freshman in college. I'm not a very disciplined person. Well, how do I get discipline if I don't have it? Well, first the coach, in a sense, externally imposes it on me. He makes me run some laps. He makes me do some push-ups. He makes me do something, right? And I might even grumble and moan about it. But if he's a really good teacher and mentor, he's going to do it by model, he's going to do it through love, and he's going to start to inculcate that. I'm going to start to pick that up myself so that within a short period of time, maybe it's a year, maybe it's 2 years, I start to become a disciplined person. So regardless of whether my coach was there or not, I want to do these things because I know they're the right things to do. That's what sport can do. It can help develop the various virtues, the parts of our character that make us a good person, that lead us ultimately to lead a happy life.
And I'll suggest another angle on it, because I grew up probably like you did. I mean, I grew up playing Little League baseball from the time I could remember, football, some basketball. I was never very good at basketball, a lot of golf. But sports at a young age put me in a situation where I was under pressure. It put me in a situation where my passions ran high. You know, when somebody did something unfair, unsportsmanlike, or took a swing at me, or took a cheap shot, or taunted me, as they often do in those age. And so I was confronted with the kind of morally charged situations that I wouldn't have been confronted with until I was an adult. And so I had these morally charged situations playing a team sport, which I had to, at the age of 11 and 12 and 13, learn how to deal with long before probably I would have ever faced them for real.
Yeah, and what I think everybody that has ever done any kind of sport play, at any level, by the way, it doesn't have to be you played pro or went to the Olympics or something, but by that sports participation, what I found very interesting is that how you practiced, how you competed, you tend to take into the world with anything you do, whatever future, maybe career, job, your marriage, you know, what, your friendships, whatever it might be, you tend to take the same approach to it. So if you are well-formed in that experience, it really serves you well as you go into other aspects and other parts of your life. And even the choosing of words, for example, you know, you said, which is very true, most people would say it, you know, I'm under a lot of pressure. And I always say, really? You know, can you hand that to me? It doesn't exist. I mean, pressure is perception. It's just how...
By the way, that's where I want to go to this chapter in your book. We're talking with Dr. Bill Thurfelder, president of Belmont Abbey, about his book, Less Than a Minute to Go. And you have a chapter here called The Pressure's On. And I must say, you talk about pressure in a way that I've never seen it before. I've never encountered such a gleeful kind of embrace of pleasure, of pressure. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as I just said, you know, it doesn't exist. I know people, what do you mean it doesn't exist? I'm feeling it. Well, what you're feeling is what you're thinking about a situation, and it really is something that is kind of self-created. You know, people say to me, well, yeah, but I'll ask a group of people, say, you know, how many of you ever said you have to go to work? You know, a whole room raised their hand. I said, you know, well, no, you don't. And then they look at me like I'm crazy. Like, what do you mean I don't have to go to work? You know, how am I going to live? How am I going to have a, well, who said you have to live that way? That could be ridiculous. No, I'm not.
You're playing Socrates when you do that, right?
You say it again?
You're playing Socrates.
Yes. I wish.
No, but you are. You're posing foundational questions that drive a person to go to as deep down as they can go to figure out why they do what they do.
Yes. Yes, and you're far better at it than I am, but, you know, God gives me these little stories and anecdotes and things to try to get people to do just what you've described, which is to begin to challenge the way they think and believe about things. You know, there are no real have-tos. I mean, we do things because we want to. I mean, think of this as a change in your perspective on life if you said, I want to go to work today. You don't have to go. You want to go.
Right.
And the truth is, you do want to go because you may want the things that brings you.
Should we then eliminate the feeling of pressure by simply thinking it away?
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean
is that how you treat pressure, simply by taking the pressure off yourself, as it were?
Well, it's just seeing the truth. In other words, it's looking at a situation and saying, what is it that I'm claiming is causing this thing I'm calling pressure? Well, I'm thinking, if I don't make this happen, then something bad's going to happen to me. Well, let's examine that. What's the bad thing that's going to happen to you? And you say, well, you know, people won't like me. Are you telling me that because you didn't, let's say, play golf well, or you didn't play the instrument well, that people who love you are going to stop loving you? I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course they're going to continue to love you. And anybody who looks like they stopped loving you because you're not playing well never loved you to start with.
Okay, now I'm going to really make a confession. The thing that I had to get over, the biggest thing to start winning tournaments, was I'll be in the middle of a round playing very well, and then I'll start thinking about going home and showing my wife, my daughter, and my son the trophy.
Right.
I'll start thinking about telling, you know, being able to tell them I won or to show them I won. And right. That inevitably does me in.
Yes,
and I had to consciously stop doing that.
Good. That's great. I mean, that's exactly how it works. In other words, because we talk about these things doesn't mean the thoughts won't ever enter your head, but you just did the right thing. You said, nope, I'm not going to stop.
And you not going there.
Focus yourself on what you were doing.
Now, I want to pose,
in
the time we have left, I want to pose a challenge to you.
Okay.
Now that I'm sort of the optimistic golfer, and I am. I mean, a cheerful golfer. I don't follow negatives. I don't beat myself for bad shots or bad ground. I mean, I really have quite a changed ad. Not that I was ever a grumpy golfer, but I did let things go on in my mind that I didn't necessarily express that hurt my performance. So, but I have friends who are still, you know, after years of golf, are still very negative. Or after year, they're very negative about their situation in life, work, and so forth. And so when they start uttering negatives, I say, you can't say that. Stop saying that. Stop it. And, of course, they'll get a little mad at me because I'm pretty firm about it. I say, stop that. Like, I have a friend who wants to say, I hate playing bad golf. And I say, what bad golf? What are you talking about? I don't see any bad golf out here.
Right, right.
You know, and, of course, I'm channeling you. Of course, I'm channeling your book. And they get, and you know, at first they're kind of angry, and then finally, in one case I'm thinking, you know, they finally sort of got it. You know, they finally realize that they were getting in their own way. But this is what they have to get over. These are people who value telling the truth. That's what they always hit me with. They always hit me with, but it's the truth. It was a bad shot. It's the truth. I did buckle under pressure. It's the truth. I did hit a lousy putt. And I have found myself saying to them, this is one case where you don't have to tell yourself the truth.
No. I challenge it deeper than that. I'd say they believe they're telling the truth, but they're actually not. In other words, to your point, you brought it up already. When somebody says, I made a bad shot, do you have any idea what that means? They did something.
Right.
So the truth is they did something. So what did they do? That is a judgment. That has nothing to do with what they did. If you said, hey, I turned my wrist in, fantastic, perfect. But saying you had a bad shot doesn't tell you anything about your wrist, doesn't tell you about what you actually did.
But you're actually you're putting a layer of interpretation upon what you have actually done.
Yes.
And it's a negative interpretation.
Yes, and it does you absolutely no matter if it hurts you. But not only does it do you no good, it actually hurts you.
So, in other words, it's not that you don't have to tell the truth. You can tell the truth, but if you tell the truth, the real truth, as opposed to the interpretation of it, that it comes about as a kind of self-flagellation.
Yeah, I mean, what is true about that? In other words, you know, it's all that's a judgment call whether you're calling it bad or good. I mean, what if you were a paraplegic? Would you call it a bad shot? I mean, you'd say, hey, that was a great shot for a paraplegic. You know, you can't even move. So you see what I'm saying? Like, it that would all just be subjective and judgmental kind of stuff. The bottom line is, to order to improve in life, you need to have awareness and know what you did. In other words, how did I move? I put a ball in a certain spot. I did that because I did certain things. Do I know what those were? Can I feel them? Not intellectually talk about them. Can I feel them? And if I can feel what I did, I can change them if I want to.
So what do I then, if somebody, you know, insists that they should be allowed to articulate their negative thoughts about their life, like, I can't get a job, nobody wants me, I've been on the job market year, you know, I'm overqualified, blah, blah, blah. And then I try to say, look, by articulating this negative attitude toward whether it's your golf game or your search for a job, you're actually creating a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. You are making it more likely that the very thing you want to avoid will continue.
Because you're not focused on what you're trying to do. So if you wanted a better position, or you want to improve your situation in life or your relationships with your spouse or whatever it is, instead of putting all that energy into doing that, you're putting it into talking about things that have nothing to do with actually improving your situation, which means you won't improve your situation, which, to your point, then it becomes a self-fulfilling.
And then they come back with me, but it's the truth.
But it's not the truth. What you did is the truth. Not your judgment's the truth. What you did is the truth.
And I find that
some people can say to you, look, I just want to be happy in hell.
Right.
You know, okay, I can't stop you. If that's where you want to be and you want to go and do that, you have free will. God can let you do, you know, he let you do this. So if you want to create a hell for yourself, you can do it and you can stay in it. The point is, you don't have to. And you're trying to claim you have to, and I'm telling you there's another way of doing it. You're just refusing either to accept that, or you just don't want to do it. But that's up to you then. It's your choice.
I find the more deeply religious a person is, or the more deeply moral they are, the more likely they are to this kind of negativity.
Perhaps
because they feel themselves so committed to being honest and truthful. And I know you're saying this is not the truth, but this is what they think honesty and truthfulness is.
Well, what you can say to them is, it's true that you believe you're a bad person. I believe that's true. What does that have to do with what you're doing?
But doesn't believing you're a bad person sort of make the hole deeper?
Sure, especially if it's not true.
Right, exactly.
But I guess what I'm saying, it's going to sound like we're playing with words here, but if somebody tells me, I believe I'm a bad person, well, I'll take your word for it. I'm believing you that you believe that you are a bad person, but in fact you're not, and I can show you ways that you're not a bad person. So, you know, what you're telling me is you do certain things, and now I can ask you, do you want to continue to do those certain things? Do you want to still continue to live that way or perform that way or do those things? And if you know those things make you unhappy, I assume if you're a rational person, you're going to say, well, no, I prefer not to do those things. I prefer to do the things that will make me happy.
I'm talking with Dr. Bill Thurfelder, president of Belmont Abbey College in Charlotte and author of Less Than a Minute to Go, wonderful book. Can you give us in 1 minute basically the connection that you make between all this good advice, wise advice, and your Christian faith?
Well, again, it comes down to the end of the book, as you read, really takes you to a very different place than the book starts, but it gets down to, why would you make these sacrifices in your life? Everybody's going to face sacrifices. Everybody's going to face difficult challenges in their life, very difficult challenges at times. How are you going to take it? What is your purpose? And is your purpose strong enough? And really, ultimately, I believe it gets down to your belief in the fact that God does exist, that he is a good God, and that he has my best interest at heart. And although I may not always understand what he has me going through, I trust in his divine providence. I trust that he will bring the best, you know, he'll bring good out of evil. He'll bring it to the sum of its goodness in the end. I'm not sure how. Sometimes it'll happen. Sometimes I can see it. Sometimes I can't. But I do trust in him. And therefore, if I approach everything in my life as a steward of what he's given me, it frees me up, because next to him, I am nothing. I know nothing. I have nothing. So there, I don't have to worry about, hey, I'm not going to be perceived as being this great person or doing something, you know, wonderful. I recognize that God, next to him, I am nothing. And he's given me everything that I have. He has given it to me. And my duty then, and my desire, is to double those talents, to do the most I can with what he's given me. And so I try to do that in every aspect of my life. And as I try to do that, knowing that I will fail at times, that I will fall down, but that's where I trust in his mercy and his grace for me to say, hey, I'm going to help you back up and keep going, and I try to keep going. And that's a happy life. That's a good life. That's one that you can be very content with, and that you certainly, again, living in the present moment is the thing to do, both in sport and in life.
Dr. Bill Thurfelder, thank you for being my guest on Church and Culture. And to all of you who are listening, please come back to meet more very interesting guests. Thank you, Bill.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the North American Orthodox and Catholic Theological Consultation recently put out a significant statement regarding the ordination of married men to the priesthood in the Eastern Catholic churches in America.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. St. Paul reminds the Corinthian Christians that the Lord's Supper is more than a meeting of friends. It's also a memorial of the redeeming sacrifice of Christ. Those who take part in it, the apostle explains, are united with the death of the Lord and proclaim him until he comes. So yes, it's true, we can say, were you there when they crucified the Lord? At the same time, we enter into a deep communion with him in this memorial of Easter, which makes us missionaries of the passion, death, and resurrection of our Lord. Today in this feast, we are reliving this wonderful reality in the solemnity of Corpus Christi, during which the Church not only celebrates the Eucharist, but in many places solemnly bears it in procession, publicly proclaiming that Christ's sacrifice is for the salvation of the whole world. Pope John Paul II said, Ecclesia de Eucharistia vivit. The Church draws her life from the Eucharist. Ever since Pentecost, when the Church, the people of the New Covenant, began her pilgrim journey towards her heavenly homeland, the divine sacrament marks the passing of her days, filling them with comfort and hope. The Eucharist is the source and summit of the life and mission of the Church. Through the Eucharist, the Church family is built up as a new Jerusalem, destined to be a principle of unity in Christ among different persons and peoples and cultures. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read this Sunday at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
This is Life News Radio. I'm Jim Anderson. The family of Justina Pelletier is still upset that their daughter could be essentially abducted by the state over an ideologically driven gambit to ostensibly lower costs for government health care. Yesterday, Lou Pelletier said that this is not over until we stop this from happening to all children. The family is now promising legal action against the state of Massachusetts. Republicans in the U.S. House have another number two behind Speaker of the House John Boehner. Former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost a primary election, stepped down, and GOP representatives replaced him with another pro-life advocate, Kevin McCarthy of California. This is Life News Radio. Slavery was wrong for something more than some notion that we don't like slavery anymore. It was wrong because property rights, which slave owners tried to claim, could not compare with the rights lost by those persons called